The Catholic Channel, Sirius 159, and XM 117 presents Just Love, a conversation on the Church's social mission with Monsignor Kevin Sullivan.
Welcome to Just Love. I'm Monsignor Kevin Sullivan. Just love. Just do it. Just love God. Just love your neighbor. Just love yourself. And if we all do that, our world will be more just and more compassionate. You know, while most of us are located 1,000 miles away in our own kind of areas, in the United States, for the most part, the people who are listening to Just Love today, the events in the Middle East continue to dominate the news. And just last week, the insurgent militant group called the Islamic State, ISIS or ISIL, seized control of two major cities in Iraq and Syria. And today on Just Love, we'll be discussing those actions as well as just who ISIL or ISIS is and what's their effect on the local communities in the Middle East. Now, I know that certainly all the news is covering those events, but we're going to have a take on it which is a little bit different because our second guest is a religious sister who is from that area. She was forced to flee her home in Mosul, Iraq, and so she'll be able to give us kind of a firsthand idea of what's going on in that very troubled part of the world. And to kind of set the context for that, our first guest is an expert on international affairs, and he's currently trying to shed light on the issues of war, peace, social justice. David Speedy is the director of U.S. Global Engagement Program, a senior fellow at the Carnegie Council. And our second guest, Sister Diane Momeka, is a sister of St. Catherine of Siena of Iraq. And so, you know, as we kind of just finish our Memorial Day weekend last week, and we kind of think about the soldiers who die in war, we realize that our world is not such a peaceful place and people are dying and we may not have fully declared wars, but we certainly have people dying in a variety of conflicts in different parts of the world, whether they be civil wars, whether they be wars with neighbors, or whether they be wars within different warring groups within a country. There is a lot of violence going on in our world. And, you know, Just Love, we say just do it, just love God, just love your neighbor, just love yourself. And for us, love involves justice. So it involves trying to figure out how rights are respected, how people's get the basic necessities of life. And our Catholic tradition does talk specifically about a just war. And what are those times when it is justified to use violence because there are basic human rights that are being threatened? And how do we engage in those conflicts? And so the topic today is very, very much part of our attempt to understand how the world becomes more just from our Catholic Christian perspective. Tom, you got any news for us before we go to our first guest?
I do, Monsieur. You know, you were mentioning a little bit about how we need to remember those victims of violence and the victims of war. And actually, this past Saturday, people may forget about a week ago today, May 23rd, was the Day of Remembrance for Persecuted Christians around the world. And the Italian Episcopal Conference actually launched an initiative to remember and pray for Christians who've been martyred that corresponded to the eve of last week, which was Pentecost. And they have a hashtag for this. It's called #FreeToPray. #FreeToPray. And Pope Francis himself has supported this Day of Remembrance for Christians who are persecuted and martyred around the world. He said, "What we need to do is break the walls of indifference and cynicism across every denomination and support those who are struggling to exercise their religion in freedom and dignity." So, again, we do remember that, Monsignor, and we have to remember those Christians who are being persecuted. We're blessed in the United States. We have freedom of religion and those other wonderful rights, but not everyone does around the world.
That's absolutely true. And what I'm going to speak with our first guest when we go to him in just a few minutes is oftentimes that kind of mix between a political, an economic, a religious reality in a situation. And there are lots of different causes or motives that are part of people engaging in war. So I'm glad you mentioned that. And that's an important factor that we need to kind of keep in mind. So why don't we go to our first guest. Our first guest is from the Carnegie Council. He is a senior fellow there, David Speedy, who is the director of U.S. Global Engagement Program at the Carnegie Council. David, thank you so much for being with us on Just Love.
Good to be with you, Monsignor. Thank you.
Hey, so tell us a little bit about the Carnegie Council. I mean, I know I'm in New York, so I know about Carnegie Hall. I know about Carnegie Mellon. I know the Carnegie Deli. But so tell us about this Carnegie Council.
Well, the first thing to understand, and please, you're in a majority of about 99.9%, that as a Scot who grew up about 15 miles from the birthplace of the great man, the correct pronunciation is Carnegie, accent on the first syllable. But, of course, that's a hopeless task to get all Americans, especially New Yorkers, with Carnegie Hall, so the correct pronunciation, I'm sorry, is Carnegie. I've done it myself. Carnegie is the correct pronunciation.
Ah, okay, so Carnegie.
Carnegie, yes.
Well, I'll get it, I promise, I'll get it right once and wrong 20 times.
Perfectly
so.
All right.
Okay, that
perfectly
is...
all right. The council is one of many, and I was very taken by your opening comments, Monsignor, and by Tom Dobbins, because obviously... the interlocking of human rights, justice, freedom from persecution, and so on and so forth is very much part of the discussion we'll have today, because this group, ISIL, is clearly a major perpetrator of outrages against all of these human values. But the Carnegie Council is basically set established as an educational come think tank institution to inject the role of ethics into the discussion of public affairs and specifically international affairs. It's 100 years old, set up by Andrew Carnegie in 1914, so we just celebrated our centenary.
Ah, a lot of those names, you know, Carnegie Council,
excellent.
Carnegie University, and
Carnegie Mellon, Carnegie Endowment for International Peace, Carnegie Corporation of New York, where I worked for several years, all set up by the great man with a view to trying to encourage world peace at a time when the drumbeat of war was pretty obvious in the early 20th century.
Pretty decent guy?
Generally a pretty good guy. A bit of a checkered past. He had a bit of a problem with strikers and labor unions and so on. He was a tough little fellow, but...
He made a few bucks, didn't he?
And of course, his most famous quote is, "The man who dies rich dies disgraced." And he, in a sense, he failed in that regard because he could not give away all of his money before he died. But we're keeping on the tradition.
Well, that is good. So, all right, David, we're speaking with David Speedy, who is the director for U.S. Global Engagement Program, a senior fellow at the Carnegie Council, and give us 101 for our listeners on what's going on with ISIL, ISIS. Why do we use two different names for it? And so give our listeners the 101 to get us into this conversation.
Well, it began, basically, ISIS is perhaps a more familiar term. It stands, of course, for the Islamic State in Iraq and Syria. I prefer ISIL, as does the President Obama's administration, because that stands for the Islamic State of Iraq and the Levant. The Levant, of course, is the area around the Eastern Mediterranean that includes places like Lebanon and so on and so forth. And clearly, as we may get into in a minute or two, ISIL has ambitions beyond, although their major disruption and outrages have been perpetrated in Iraq and Syria, they go beyond those two countries. It began in 1999, actually started by a Jordanian, which is interesting because it's been reported that their next target is Jordan. You know, they're trying to pick off these different Sunni countries. Began in 1999 and pledged allegiance originally to al-Qaeda back in 2004. It took part in the Iraqi insurgency, which followed the 2003 war in Iraq. But as many of these characters do, they quickly fell out with each other. And al-Qaeda cut all ties to ISIL in February of 1914, accusing them of intransigence, which is an interesting thing for al-Qaeda to be accusing people of. Anyway, it's one of these sort of loose affiliation of terrorist organizations that range really basically from the Middle East and North Africa all the way to Southeast Indonesia, where there are also militant Islamic movements.
Now, if you were to kind of say, so from an organizational perspective, they all came together, they're loose. What do they want to achieve? What's their goal?
Well, they're different from Al-Qaeda in at least one important way. Al-Qaeda is basically there to attack the infidel, which, of course, is the United States, 9/11. They are basically a group that exists to carry out terrorist acts in the name of extreme Islam, sometimes called Salafism, after the name of the movement that has created this extreme form of Sunni Islam. ISIL is different in that it basically, the key word in their title is state. They want to create a state or caliphate across an extended region, basically from, I guess, Morocco to wherever, you know, to Afghanistan. And so they have territorial ambitions that Al-Qaeda does not have. Al-Qaeda is an attacking force. It's a terrorist organization that carries out terrorist attacks. ISIL has ambitions to seize and control territory. And in fact, their current leader, a man called Abu Bahi al-Baghdadi, describes himself as the caliph, or essentially the head of this would-be transnational caliphate or nation.
So would it be fair, if even maybe a little bit imprecise, to translate caliphate as nation?
It's about right. I mean, it's a caliphate is, of course, an Islamic term that means a sort of an official national status. Yes, exactly.
Now, again, if my history is not great, but I think the idea of a caliphate goes back pretty far. And you mentioned Morocco. Wasn't there actually a caliphate in Cordoba in the Middle Ages?
Oh, yes, absolutely. There was, as I recall, Caliph of Baghdad, it is an established term that they are drawing on to describe and to essentially codify their ambitions.
Now, I mean, it's not uncommon for groups to kind of want to take over a country, either a revolution or to get power in a nation or something like that. I mean, we're now dealing with the fact that, that Ukraine has been divided up a little bit. And but having said that, there does seem to be something really different about ISIL than some of the other movements in the world.
Well, of course. I mean, and the first thing, and the other thing to be that I should have mentioned earlier about the form of Islamic government known as a caliphate is that the caliph is a person either considered or considering himself to be a political and religious successor to the Prophet Muhammad. So, I mean, much more than just your run-of-the-mill president or prime minister. Clearly. And clearly what also sets off this from other would-be movements, and certainly the situation in Ukraine, is just the sheer brutality with which ISIL, you know, seeks to impose its will. It doesn't only go into the ancient, city of Palmyra last week and capture the city and threaten historic monuments. Palmyra was particularly poignant because it's a UNESCO, it's a designated UNESCO heritage site. But they also assassinated, beheaded, killed 300 people, including women and children. So it's the sheer brutality with which they, you know, Ukraine, we don't have time to get into Ukraine, but Ukraine is essentially in a situation of civil war, where it's really two countries, East and West, and there is basically a civil war going on. This is something different, where an external force, in this case ISIL, comes in with extreme brutality and very little sort of notion of what we would consider state building or nation building.
I mean, to me, a simple question with not a simple answer. Why? Why are they so brutal?
Well, that's a very good question. And I mean, they are so brutal that two things have happened. First of all, you know, even some mainstream Sunni Muslim in late August of 2014, the Grand Mufti of Saudi Arabia, condemned ISIL, you know, and for their what he called extremist and militant ideas that spread decay on earth, destroying human civilization, not in any way part of Islam. So I mean that they've even sort of even among the Supreme Mufti, the Grand Mufti of Saudi Arabia, that's a pretty conservative Sunni Muslim country. So he expressed outrage at what they do. Basically, they are just sort of, you know, what you would call in the worst sense true believers, people who at the extreme end of Islam, this form of, as I said, Salafism, which has always been at the extreme end of Sunni Islam. And they just have a completely distorted view of everything from the rights of women, and children, the role of culture in everyday life. It is just an off the charts view that, and of course, the more extreme the view, the more extreme the measures and the determination to impose their will.
Well, you know, it, from everything you've said and what is all on the news, as I can say, this is not good news. This is not a positive movement in any way. So let me ask you kind of, you know, the question which I think is on everybody's mind is so what do we do about it?
Well, you know, basically that of course is the $64,000 question, and the president has come under strong condemnation, especially from the right wing in the Senate. For not sort of, you know, the boots on the ground thing. In fact, I think the president's right in this regard. There really isn't much to be done for Westerners, especially the United States, starting putting boots on the ground against ISIL. And I also think that ISIL's future can be overestimated, as it were. Several things here. First of all, they have broad range of ambition from Libya to the Sinai to Algeria to Yemen to West Africa and so on and so forth. It's estimated that they have about maybe altogether, not just ISIL, but in the various jihadi conflicts, there are 25,000 foreign fighters taking place. Now, they are widespread. They come from maybe 100 foreign countries. So this really is an international movement. But it always has been. Al-Qaeda had people from the Chechen region of Russia, from Chechnya, from Uzbekistan and Central Asia. It's always been a group of fringe elements from across the world. Their impact, I think, will be diluted by the sheer range of their ambition. Because what ISIL is good at is moving in, grabbing a place like Anbar in Iraq. And by the way, there's already a significant move on to recapture the Anbar province, Anbar and Salaheddin, with the main city of Ramadi that people read about last week. So that's underway. What they have done is they swoop down, they grab a place. They're not so good at holding on to it because they don't have, frankly, the number of forces. So I think they're the fact that they're not getting as much of a revenue stream. The Iraqis, with any luck, will cut off the oil supply from northern Iraq. That they grab oil and refine it and sell it to raise money. They're not getting as many hostages because people are being a bit more careful about where they send their business people and relief workers into harm's way. So we had an expert here, Professor Juan Cole from the University of Michigan, who really is one of the leading experts on Islamic terrorism, and he was asked a question from our audience, and he said basically, ISIL will be history in 2 to 3 to 4 years.
Because it's relatively small and it's
relatively
going to be
small, overstretching itself, and because of its tactics of trying to, you know, it can't sort of, if it, let's put it this way, if it focused on one place, if it simply stayed in Syria, then we would have a problem. But of course now it's looking to move into Jordan, and it has ambitions in all these other places that I mentioned. So stretching too thin.
Now, but you can't ignore it, right?
Oh no, not at all.
So how do you deal with it?
Well, how you deal with it is basically, I think two ways. One is direct. We have to. Our Secretary of Defense Ash Carter over the weekend was pretty critical about the latest setback in Iraq. Where
actually, you know what? I really, I mean, I don't know. whether he's right or wrong. I suspect he's right, only because it's not something that that secretaries of defense are supposed to say.
Yeah.
And I mean, my read on life, and correct me if I'm wrong, that he just got so frustrated because we're doing all this stuff and these guys, he doesn't think, are fighting hard enough.
Well, it's complicated in the following sense, in that I think he is right. You know, 200 or so ISIL fighters managed to put to flight 2,500 Iraqi army, which we spent billions of dollars training over the past few years since our retreat from Iraq, our withdrawal from Iraq. On the other hand, the criticism from the Iraqis was that there's American air bases here, and we've been too parsimonious in our bombing raids against ISIL. The administration is very leery of this because it was reported in the New York Times over the weekend. They are very, very reticent to incur any civilian casualties beyond the absolute, simply because of all the drone attacks in Afghanistan and Pakistan and the criticism they came in for there. But, you know, you're right. There is a certain, there's a division within the administration here. Vice President Biden called Iraq over the weekend to sort of say, wait a minute, we really appreciate all the brave the fight you put into combating these terrorists. So there may be a little bit of a tension going on within the administration. But
So you talked about maybe 25,000 fighters, but do they have I don't know what the size of our armed forces in the United States is, but we got a country of hundreds of millions.
Yeah.
So in addition to the soldiers, those fighting, do they have like a civilian population?
ISIL?
Yeah.
Clearly there are some civilian sympathizers. And by the way, the 25,000 estimate is an estimate of all the jihadist forces fighting across the world, not just ISIL.
Ah,
so,
okay.
You know, it includes Al-Qaeda and so on. But on the other hand, Monsignor, one other thing that's happened is that the sheer brutality of ISIL has not only turned the forces against them at a sort of local level. For example, some Syrian refugees who fled the conflict talked about them as foreign occupiers precisely because they have combatants from all across the world. And the other great, of course, the other concern in this very complicated picture, sorry to be so shorthand about it, is the concern that ISIL forces are recruited even from Western Europe, you know, from the UK, from France, from Belgium, Italy, and so on and so forth, and then they come back and perpetrate acts against their own countries. In fact, what we're seeing is that there have been many cases of people deserting ISIL and coming back just because of the sheer horror. You know, the scales have fallen from the eyes about the sheer horror of ISIL's tactics and what it does. So it works both ways. Yes, there's a concern that we're maybe creating, a new breed of terrorists, but the numbers are not that great, number one. And number two, there is this backlash against ISIL itself.
On the surface, it seems to me what you've described in terms of a goal is to establish this far-reaching caliphate, which I assume would be under Islamic law, and to kind of set up this, I would say, religious Muslim state, extreme Muslim state. But is there anything else to it? Is there an economic motive? Is there a political or is it primarily kind of fanatical religion gone wild?
It's a very good question, and I frankly I don't think we've been able to sort of analyze the ramifications of ISIL beyond the sheer just setting up this as you say, extreme ultra religious state. I'll tell you one amusing thing was that when Baghdadi appeared somewhere in Syria, I believe, he was photographed giving ranting and raving, and suddenly someone realized that he was wearing a Rolex watch, and this caused great amusement among the locals. Here was this austere, ultra-religious caliph, self-appointed, self-proclaimed caliph with a, 30,000, whatever the heck a Rolex costs. So they called him the caliph with the Rolex.
Yeah.
So, Yeah, obviously materialism may not be 1,000 miles away from the ambitions, at least at the leadership, but we don't know that for sure.
Hey, you know, I want to thank you. I really thanks so much. Very enlightening. It was, boy, I got to be a lot smarter, which isn't hard to make me a lot smarter because I began low, but it really was very, very enlightening, and I think it gave our listeners a sense of something that is so complex that you really did it. So
I may just say two quick things.
Please.
First of all, you know, you always say this is a hard act to follow. From describing your next guest, this is a hard act to proceed. So I'll look forward to with great interest. And the other thing I want to just say that, you know, here at the Carnegie Council for Ethics and International Affairs, a couple of weeks ago we had a big session. Important session on nuclear weapons, the Catholic perspectives on nuclear nonproliferation and disarmament. And we had Archbishop Bernardito Alza, who's the Holy See representative, of course, to the UN. We had an old friend and a bit of a hero of mine, Father Brian Hare from Harvard.
Know him well.
And it was a terrific panel. So it should be up on our website, carnegiecouncil.org, in the next couple of weeks or so. So I'd urge your listeners, it really is an important question, the ethical questions of the world's worst weapons.
Well, I think it is true, and I Brian has been a guest on our show on Just Love, and an excellent guest, and I've worked with him, just a very, very clear, analytical thinker, and I try to convince him that the world sometimes is a little broader than 3 points. Sometimes it's 4 points, but
that's the academic thing.
That's
three
true.
That's
hey,
right.
but David Speedy, director of the U.S. Global Engagement Program, senior fellow at the Carnegie Council.
Excellent.
Thanks so much for being with us, and thanks for being a guest on Just Love. We are going to take a break, and when we come back a little bit later on in the show, we're going to speak with somebody who has really firsthand experience, Sister Diana Momica, who is a sister of Catherine of Siena of Iraq. She was educated in Mosul, and she has become a refugee fleeing the dangerous situation that is there. So we'll take a break, Tom, and we'll be back in just 2 minutes. I'm Monsignor Kevin Sullivan. This is Just Love, the Catholic Channel, Sirius XM 129.
The Catholic Channel, Sirius 159, and XM 117 presents Just Love, a conversation on the Church's social mission with Monsignor Kevin Sullivan.
Welcome back to Just Love. I am Monsignor Kevin Sullivan. This is The Catholic Channel, Sirius XM 129. And thank you for being with us. And this week we're talking about one of those real trouble spots of the world, the Middle East. And we just had a conversation about ISIL or ISIS with David Speedy, who is a senior fellow at the Carnegie Council. And we spoke about some of the difficulties with ISIS and its very brutality in what it's doing. A little bit later on in the show, we're going to speak with Sister Diana Momica, who is a sister of St. Catherine of Siena of Iraq. And she is actually somebody who has fled Iraq. She was educated there. And we're going to speak with her about her experience of what's going on in that situation. Tom, we got any news you want to share with our listeners?
Sure, Monsieur. You know, we're talking about places in the world where there were difficult situations. Well, you know, last weekend, as many people may wind up recalling, there was a major event down in San Salvador and El Salvador. Over 300,000 people turned out to see Archbishop Oscar Romero beatified, which is, of course, the final stage for sainthood in the Catholic Church.
No. It's not making him a saint.
No, it's not making him a saint. Pardon me. He's beatified. Yes, I would say all it's right. The final stage before.
So we go through this. Now, in order to get to be one of those biggie saints. Now, listen, our listeners need to know this. And Victoria, you need to know this too, okay? Now, kind of in the basic understanding, okay, is saints are in heaven. So if you get into heaven, you're a saint.
I will hope so.
Okay, but but everybody in heaven, in one sense, is a saint, okay?
Right.
So, but then we have kind of the named saints. So if you just get to heaven, okay, and you don't get a named day after you, then you get celebrated on November 1st when it's All Saints Day.
Oh.
And that's kind of like the feast for the unknown saints.
So wait a minute. Let me make sure I understand.
You got it. Okay.
So if I'm not, usually in a year it's 365 days, okay? So if you're a saint, you have a day named after you, correct?
Well, but no, the biggies, like St. Francis.
Oh, okay.
He's got October 4th.
Okay.
Okay, and
I was getting ready to
St.
say,
St. Patrick.
Do I have, if
March
I'm
17th.
The 366th person to die.
Oh, no, you can have more than one. Okay. No, you can have more than one.
I just
want
to check.
You can back up. You can have more than one on a day.
Okay.
But, you know, not everybody gets a day, and not everybody gets a saint named. You know, you don't get your own name day.
Right.
Okay. But
unless it's my birthday.
Yeah, but you can still be a saint.
Yes.
You still be a saint and get to heaven.
Mm-hmm.
It's just you don't got a special day. Okay. So what the church says is that there are some people who they had such good lives and they did such extraordinary things that it's worth kind of raising them up, giving them a day, and have other people try to figure out if there's some good example in them that can help them to be better people. But in order to get that special name, to be a formal saint, you got to go through processes.
I'm sure you have a whole day named after you.
Yeah,
I'm sure you have to go through a process.
Yeah, so like the first thing you are is Tom, you know what the first thing you are?
Is it you're a friend of God?
No, servant of God.
Servant of God, okay.
Servant of God. So in the beginning, that you kind of means like, you know, you were okay. So you get to be a servant of God. And then they do a little bit more looking into your life. And then if they find some more good things about you, then they finally declare you. The next thing they say, not only is this woman or man a servant of God, you're also, what's the next one?
Blessed.
No.
No?
Venerable.
Venerable. Okay.
See, I didn't
know
that.
Okay.
See, you're venerable.
Okay.
So that's like a step up the ladder.
Okay.
Learn something.
All right. And then what you just talked about, Archbishop Romero, then there's the third rung up the ladder.
Okay.
Okay?
Okay.
You get to be blessed or beatified.
Mm-hmm.
So that's the third rung up the ladder.
Wow.
Okay? And then finally, you get to be
a saint.
A saint.
A declared saint.
So you got to go up the ladder. Okay?
Yep, that's a lot.
It's almost
a lot. It's a lot, but hey, you want a name after you, you want to be in the book, and you want to get everybody knows your name, hey, you got to do some stuff for it. And the part of it that, and I think I got that right, but they keep changing the rules a little bit.
Mm.
Okay, they keep changing the rules a little bit so that, like, you used to need miracles and more miracles, but then the Pope can say, eh, don't need a miracle and stuff like that. So Archbishop Romero got to be, I think he got to be the third rung of the ladder, right?
He's the third rung of the ladder, Monsignor, yes, I would say. And about it was about 300,000 people gathered, which they feel was the largest religious celebration in Central American history.
Okay.
So over 300,000 people turned out. President Obama sent a greeting. Pope Francis sent a greeting where he sort of talked a little bit about Bishop Romero. And then he basically said, regarding Bishop Romero, he lived out his faith, and when it's fully understood, faith in Jesus Christ generates communities of workers for peace and solidarity. So he was kind of saying that, I guess, as he goes up that rung, he has encouraged, he himself was a worker for peace and solidarity, and he's encouraging others.
Okay, good deal. You know what? I think we're going to take a break, and when we come back, we're going to speak with Sister Diana Momica, who is a sister of St. Catherine of Siena of Iraq. She was educated in Mosul, but she is now a refugee. She fled from Iraq because of the dangerous situation there, and her community actually has had a number of sisters over the years who have died in various types of persecution. And so we're looking forward to speaking to her when we come back. I'm Monsignor Kevin Sullivan. This is Just Love, the Catholic Channel, Sirius XM 129.
The Catholic Channel, Sirius 159, and XM 117 presents Just Love, a conversation on the Church's social mission with Monsignor Kevin Sullivan.
Welcome back to Just Love. This is our weekly conversation about the Church and the world. Just love. Just do it. Just love God. Just love your neighbor. Just love yourself. And we'll make our world a more just, a more compassionate place. Unfortunately, that's not the case in so many parts of the world. And this week, We're speaking about a particularly troubled part of the world. We're speaking about the Middle East. We just had a conversation about ISIL or ISIS, and they've taken over control of two major cities in Iraq and Syria. And that's created a great deal of pain, a great deal of violence in those situations, the brutality of their presence in a place. And we're going to be speaking right now to Sister Diana Momika, sister of St. Catherine of Siena of Iraq, who experienced some of that really difficult situation personally herself. She was educated in Mosul, Iraq, and she was raised in Baghdad. And in 2008, she made her final professions to the Dominican Sisters of St. Catherine of Siena. Sister Diana, thank you so much for taking the time to be with us.
Well, thank you, Monsignor, for having me to be the voice for my own people. I appreciate this opportunity. Thank you.
Well, I'm very, very grateful that you have come on, and I'm grateful for the ministry that you have been engaged in. Would you tell our listeners a little bit about your own background, where you were born, grew up, you're becoming a sister, so they get a sense of your own personal story?
Sure, sure. I grew up in Baghdad, where my family used to live, and then, you know, because of the Iran war and the conflicts during the Gulf War, we had to move to northern of Mosul in a city or a small town by then was called Karakosh, and it's considered one of the largest towns, actually, where Christian major to live in, not anymore, unfortunately. So there where I met the Dominican Sisters, and I fell in love with them, and that's where how my vocation started, pursuing the Dominicans until I became a sister to serve the Lord and serve my people throughout the world, and especially in my hometown, and actually in my land.
The Dominican Sisters of St. Catherine of Siena, they have been there for many years, haven't they?
Our congregation was founded 1878. So by then, at the beginning, the first steps were founded by the Dominican Sisters of Presentation, originally based from France. They were sent to educate the women in Iraq, especially at the villages. So working with the women have this call that they want to serve their own people, and that's how the congregation started in 1878, where the Dominican Sisters of Presentation educated the women and gave them good information about Dominican's life, and that's how it started. And in 1928, we became a pontifical, we were recognized by the pontifical, we became a pontifical congregation.
Now, the particular ministry or charism or focus of your community is what?
First of all, it's education. We work in education, beginning from the kindergarten to high school. We used to have schools in Nineveh Plain. Unfortunately, they are gone. We used to have 12 projects of kindergarten. They are all gone after ISIS had took over all our villages and towns. We work in healthcare too. We have a hospital in Baghdad, a maternity hospital, and we were in the process of building another hospital in Karakosh, but unfortunately, as soon as we started, ISIS took over the town and we had to flee the town. So, and now we've been working actually not only in education and healthcare, we're trying to be everywhere where the IDPs are living, attending their needs, especially the humanitarian needs that they are in most need right now for it.
We're speaking with Sister Diana Momika, who is a sister of St. Catherine of Siena of Iraq, and she's speaking with us about her experience and that of her community in ministering to people in Iraq. Now, you were actually in Iraq when some of the more violent situations emerged?
Yes, I was. I returned after I finished my doctorate at Catholic Theological Union. I returned in 2012. So at that time, the situation wasn't that bad. But last year in June, when you know, when we start hearing about ISIS in Syria and what they were doing, we've never expected that would happen to us. So in June 2014, they, as you see, as you heard in the news, they overran Mosul, and Mosul is very close to the Christian towns that's surrounded by Mosul. So what happened was when ISIS took Mosul in June 10th, 2014, the Christians started marching toward the Christian towns like Tel Kef, Tulisqif, Karakosh, and then there we started to tend their needs because they were forced to leave with nothing actually on their backs. So what happened was we start to embracing them. So, but by August, you know, that the hour of danger had come when fighting started between Peshmerga and the ISIS on the border of Karakosh, and lots of missiles started falling on the houses, and a couple people were killed there. So we thought this is really serious, and that's how, you know, people start leaving, marching. We're talking about here about over than 70,000 people in one town. So, you know, when we heard the missiles falling and the bombing here and there, lots of people start leaving. But at 11:30 p.m., when we thought this is the hour that we should leave, so as the sisters and the church, we did not leave until we made sure that most of the people had left. But unfortunately, some who stayed, you know, because it happened in the night, so some they were in bed already. They did not hear about 300 to 400 persons. They stayed there who were held by hostages by ISIS when they got into our hometowns at 4 o'clock in the morning. So I consider that, Monsignor, a nightmare for us because it was a distance between Karakosh and Bartella and Nineveh Plain to Erbil is 1 hour distance. It took us 11 hours on the way, you know, marching, some by foot, some by car, even trucks. We were loading people with trucks. Imagine a pregnant woman in her 8 months going to her labors and soon, you know, and what happened that we had to load her in a truck because we didn't have enough room for them. And during our, you know, way to Kurdistan, some shooting happened there and people were scared to death, which we had to take lots of children in our van. So a van of 15 riders became a van of 25 people in one van. You know, it was a nightmare for us, which every time we recall, we feel that the hand of God, despite of everything, was with us. It reminds me of Exodus, you know, when the pillar of light was following people when they were leaving Egypt. It's the same thing happened with us. We experienced miracle during our run because we were fleeing, yet we were feeling that God was with us in every second we were marching toward Kurdistan.
Sister Diana Momica, sister of St. Catherine of Siena, Iraq, and she has just been recounting to us in just poignant detail the night in which she and other sisters helped to relocate the members of the community there who were in imminent danger from the arrival of ISIS that was there. How many sisters took part in that exodus, as you call it?
74 sisters. About 30 of them were elderly sisters. Some were unable to walk. Some they have health issues. And imagine on the way that we didn't have water, we were not prepared for such things. So, and the heat was over 120 with no AC in the cars. And, you know, it was such a hell of a night, actually.
And how many people were part of that exodus? Not merely the sisters,
but 50,000 people at least, because some had left a day earlier and some left in the morning. But those who stayed until the last minute, believing nothing would happen, we left around 11 o'clock and start, you know, until 3 o'clock. But it's lots of priests. they were helping people, you know, to get out because we saw the danger. It was coming very, very close.
And the people who left, those 50,000, were most of them Christian?
All of them Christian. All of them Christians.
And God, no, so they were all Christian and all had to flee because of the danger of ISIS coming so close.
Yes, because we were surrounded by neighborhoods that they are Muslim, you know, Muslim that they used to come. So, and, you know, attend our schools, come to have a treatment in our hospital. So what happened, sadly, lots after the displacement, people start getting phone calls from people that they used to know from neighborhood, telling them, now we're taking your homes, we're selling your stuff, and we're using what you have. And, you know, some of the stories that we heard from those who were held hostages there, you know, some of those people were that now we start losing trust in them because they were our neighbors. We used to share with things, lots of things with them, and they turned against us. That was the most painful thing for us.
Oh, I can imagine how hurtful that was. In that whole exodus of 50,000 people, were there any of the neighbors, any of the people along the way who were not part of the Christian exodus that were supportive, that were helpful?
To tell you the truth, at that night, all what we experienced, that we felt abandoned.
Wow, that's just such a moving thing. So, sister, I know this is it seems like a very superficial question, but what is it that those of us in the United States, what do we need to know more of, and what can we do to raise a voice about the situation, to help the situation?
Actually, this is a great question, Monsignor, and I'm so glad you have asked this question. First of all, what I want to really let people know that you have brothers and sisters who are Christians, who are Yazidis, and who are other minorities, are suffering. And I see when the body of a Christ one part of the body of a Christ suffer, the rest of the body feels the pain. So what I want to say to people, please feel the pain of your brothers and sisters who are suffering for their faith, because that's the only thing, because we're Christians, we wanted to keep our faith. That's what happened to us. So the way that you can do, your brothers and sisters, now they are homeless. As Jesus said, blessed if you see me homeless and, you know, you care for me, and your brothers and sisters need for your care now. Lots of humanitarian aid still in most need, and if you can help in any way you can, you know, this help will let people back, my people back in Kurdistan area who have been displaced, living in caravans, living in unfinished buildings, living 10 to 15 to 20 people in one small room. They will feel that they are not abandoned. Their Christian brothers and sisters around the world are loving them, caring for them. So if they can help provide any kind of a humanitarian aid for them, that will be the most helpful thing for us.
Are there any of the Catholic organizations that are doing some of that humanitarian work?
Yes. One of them is, you know, like one of the humanitarian organization we're working with, CNIWA, the Catholic Near East Association Welfare. They've been wonderfully helping us from day one, actually. Through the education, through the healthcare, through other things. And the other source is the Adrian Dominican Sisters. Whatever, like, you know, they are getting donations and send them right away to us to help people through providing them with the humanitarian needs that they need for daily life.
You know, Sister Monica, Sister Diana, I believe one of the Adrian Dominicans is very familiar with the situation there, and maybe even visits Sister Donna Markham.
Yes.
because Donna is now the president of Catholic Charities USA. And I believe within the past year or so, she did go visit the situation in Iraq. And that community has done a lot of very good things. Also, we did have, probably a couple of months ago, the head of Catholic Near East Welfare Association, Kaniwa, Monsignor Kozar. Yeah. He was on the show here. Mm-hmm. And so I would encourage our listeners that if they want to go on the website to find those organizations to provide relief, that is there. Sister Diana, I just want to thank you. Is there any, I know how dangerous it is there. Is there any possibility, or are you going to be able to go back, or is it just impossible these days?
I am returning back. That's my people, and they need me, and I need them. And it is not the time to abandon them, because I need them and they need me, and this is how we hold each other, you know?
Well, I thank you so much, and thanks for taking the time to speak to our listeners and to share with us. Just an incredibly difficult and moving story, and, you know, I do think it's absolutely appropriate what you said as we approach the celebration of Corpus Christi in a week or so, the Feast of the Body of Christ, right, to recognize that when any of the members are suffering, all of the members are suffering. And, you know, in this United States, we kind of pride ourselves on religious freedom. And sometimes we get upset when government does encroach somewhat on our religious freedom. But it is nothing compared with what you've gone through, the situation you've gone through. And so we need to raise our voice in solidarity and to do what we can to help humanitarian relief. So, Sister Diana, thank you so much. Thank you for the work you've done. And please, when you go back, bring the solidarity of your sisters and brothers here who just want to be in solidarity to express that fellowship and communion in the body of Christ. So, Sister Diana, thank you so much.
Thank you. Thank you, Monsignor.
Sister Diana Momica, Sister of St. Catherine of Siena of Iraq, who has been our guest. And, you know, when you hear somebody recount a story like that, Tom, Joy, I mean, it just, at least for me, sends, you know, a little bit of shivers. And, you know, it's just something that I suspect that those of us in this country, our listeners, have had very little experience of, because it's almost unimaginable to us that somebody would come in and, because of your religious belief, to kill you. And it just is, and as you talked about, Archbishop Romero in El Salvador, and the 50,000 people who, with Sister and her 73 other compatriots, members of that community, had to leave on a moment's notice. So let's raise a prayer. Let's give thanks to God for our freedom and in solidarity with the members of the body of Christ. I'm Monsignor Kevin Sullivan. This is Just Love, Just Do It. Just love God, just love your neighbor, just love yourself, and our world will be more just and compassionate. Join us again next week on the Catholic Channel, Sirius XM 129.
Listening to the Catholic Channel, Sirius XM 129.